While we don't look alike, we don't act alike, we don't dress alike, we have different tastes in the food we eat, the books we read, the films we watch, the cars we drive, and the music we enjoy. We support different football teams or have different leisure interests. We ascribe to different philosophies over politics. Our weights vary, our heights vary, so does the colour of our hair and skin. But we all have one thing in common. We all know what it means to hurt. And suffering is a universal language. We all know what it means to hurt. And I guess at some stage of our lives, we've all cried out, "Why me? Why us?" Suffering and persecution have always been the experience of the church, right from its conception. Think of the disciples. After Judas had hanged himself, there were 11 disciples. Tradition says that everyone was martyred apart from John. And he was, of course, exiled on the island of Patmos. But martyrdom and Christianity seem to go hand in glove. Today, according to the Christian organisation Open Doors, each month, 322 Christians are killed for their faith. 214 churches and Christian properties are destroyed. 772 forms of violence are committed against Christians, such as beatings, abductions, rape, arrests, and forced marriages. And according to the United States Department of State, Christians in more than 60 countries face persecution from their governments or surrounding neighbours simply because they follow Jesus Christ. Suffering and Christianity tend to be Siamese twins, don't they? I'm always reminded of Amy Carmichael's poem. Amy Carmichael was around in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was a missionary in India. She was in India for 55 years, and she's the author of 35 books. She worked amongst temple girls, girls that had been abandoned or sold to the temple, but they were used simply as prostitutes for the male people who went along there, victims of sexual abuse. And she would go in and rescue these girls. And on numerous occasions, Amy Carmichael is accused of kidnapping and often faced physical threats for the girls that she rescued and took to safety. Following a serious fall, she spent the last 20 years of her life as an invalid. And that's where her writing, I suppose, came into its own. But she wrote some incredible poems from her experience. And one poem that always challenges me is called "Hast Thou No Scar?" Let me share it with you. "Hast thou no scar, no hidden scar on foot or side or hand? I hear thee sung as mighty in the land. I hear them hail thee, thy bright ascendant star. Hast thou no scar? Hast thou no wound? Yet I was wounded by the archer's spend. Lead me against a tree to die, and rent by ravening beasts that compassed me, I swooned. Hast thou no wound? No wound, no scar. Yet as the master shall the servants be, and pierced are the feet that follow me. But thine are whole. Can he have followed far who has no wounds, no scar?" Well, the church at Smyrna understood exactly that poem. They were a scarred people. They faced persecution firsthand, and they would have said an amen to the works and the writings of Amy Carmichael. Now, as we open up this short address, all these letters follow a similar outline, and I'm going to use A just to alliterate them. First of all, address, verses 8a. "To the angel of the church in Smyrna write." To the angel of the church in Smyrna, right. What do we know about Smyrna? Well, it was a beautiful city. It was located 35 miles north of Ephesus, and the two cities rivaled each other. History records that Smyrna was given a number of titles. They were called the Pride of Asia, the Glory of Asia, the Thirst of Asia. In 700 BC, the city was destroyed and left in ruins. For 300 years, it was desolate. And then it was restored. It was literally raised from the dead. So you could say the city had died and come back to life again. And at the time this letter was written, the city had a population of 100,000 people. So the city was dead and is alive again. And how interesting, those are the very terms, the very words Jesus uses in this letter. I am the one who died and came to life again. And Smyrna was a beautiful city. They boasted of an excellent harbour, lavish temples, a famous stadium, one of the largest public theatres in Asia Minor. And it was a planned city. When it was rebuilt, they didn't just throw it together. It was planned, designed. In the middle of the city, they had a long street called the Street of Gold, which from beginning to end was full of temples. Full of temples. We have our own version in Blackpool, don't we? The Golden Mile. It's not full of temples, it's full of arcades and tourist shops and fish and chippies. But you can walk the Golden Mile at Blackpool. And of course, opposite is a mile stretch of golden sands, golden beach. And in the winter, you can catch a tram and see the illuminations. But it's a stretch, and people flock from all over the UK to Blackpool for the Golden Mile. Well, in this city, they went to worship the pagan gods. From one end of the street to the other end of the street was temple after temple after temple. And I just wonder if Jesus chose that title first and last to say, look, your street may start with foreign gods and it may end with foreign gods, but I was there long before them and I'll be there long after them. Towering over the old city was a magnificent hill, and that was called the Crown of Smyrna. The Crown of Smyrna. The hill rose up, and all around it were temples. So from a distance, it looked like a man's head studded with diamonds, with a crown. And again, quite deliberately, in verse 10, Jesus said, look, you're known, you're famous for having a crown. But if you overcome, he said, I will give you an even greater crown, the victor's crown, there in verse 10. So everything Jesus says in this opening statement is linked to the events that took place in this city. So it was a beautiful city. It was a wealthy city. It was a port. Smyrna today is called Izmir in Turkey. It is the third largest city in Turkey with about, I can't remember how many now. I think it's, there's a lot of people there. I think it's about 4 million. I've got it in my notes somewhere, but you can check it up for yourself. But it was a wealthy city because as you entered the port, they had a chain that went around the port, and so it stopped anyone stealing ships. Pirates couldn't come in and get... Once the ships were in the port and the chain was across, they were safe. And so it was a good place to dock. But that brought great wealth into the city. And it was a cultured city. I said it had been destroyed even by Alexander the Great himself, but when it was rebuilt, it was planned. Large, wide streets. And they used a special stone and they put it down in special patterns. So it was a cultured, a sophisticated city. And then the last thing that's important to us to note, it was a very patriotic city. The Roman philosopher Cicero once said, Smyrna is one of our most faithful and most ancient allies. Patriotism ran high in these broad cobblestone streets. Let me give you an idea of how much. In one campaign, the Romans were losing in 88 BC against the Mithridates. Things had gone badly wrong. The soldiers were hungry. They were destitute. But Smyrna collected food and were told that the citizens even sent their own clothes to provide clothing and food for the Roman soldiers. In return, Rome rewarded them for their patriotism. In 195 BC, they were granted and the first city in the world to erect a temple to the goddess Roma. And then in AD 26, of all the cities in Asia, Smyrna was given the privilege of having a temple to the Emperor Tiberius. That was a unique honour. But along with patriotism and loyalty to the emperor came worship of the emperor. And the city was full of guilds. cross between a kind of a trade union and the Masons. And if you belonged to the guild, you got business. And if you didn't belong to the guild, you didn't get business. But to belong to the guild wasn't hard. But it meant you went to pagan rituals and pagan ceremonies. And of course, the Christians wouldn't take part in these pagan rituals. Therefore, they were not part of the guild. Therefore, they couldn't get employment or work. They were isolated. So the patriarchalism worked against the church here in Smyrna. What do we know about the church itself? Well, very little. It's believed that about 40 years before this letter, people came down from Ephesus, they evangelized the city, and a church was formed. What we do know is about one of its most famous citizens, a man called Polycarp, and we'll come back to him later. He was a key leader, a pastor, a bishop of the church at Smyrna. So that's the address. In every letter, there's an attribute that is highlighted. And there's one here in verse 8. What is the attribute brought to our attention? These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. Like I said, I love that title, the first and the last, the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. Everything starts with Jesus, everything finishes with Jesus. Now remember, at the time of this letter, the Romans ruled the world. Before the Romans ruled this city, the Greeks ruled this city. Before the Greeks, the Persians. Before the Persians, the Lydians. And this title that Jesus gives us reminds us he was before all those civilizations. And they've all come and gone apart from the Roman one. But it's only a matter of time before someone comes along and they're shifted as well. But he will be there even after Rome. And he then adds that additional description, who died and came alive again. Now think of all those empires that ruled over this city. Plato, well, he was alive and is now dead. Alexander the Great, he was alive but is now dead. Augustus Caesar, he was alive but is now dead. Emperor Tiberius, he was alive but is now dead. With every human being, you have to put it that way around, don't you? They were alive, now they're dead. But when it comes to Jesus, it's reversed. He was the one who was dead, but is now alive. And no one else but Jesus can claim that. And it's a lovely description to these people who are hurting and suffering and may even have to die for their faith. If you've ever suffered deeply, you'll know that, if you're diagnosed with cancer, who is the best person to bring you comfort? Probably someone else who's had cancer and overcome it to give you hope. If you've lost a loved one, who's the best one to share your grief? Someone else who's lost a loved one. Because when they say, I know how you feel, they know how you feel. And to people who are about to die, who's the best one to come alongside? One who has died. But rose again. And so he takes the sting out of their situation. And he reminds them it is temporal, not permanent. He was dead, but is alive. I've been where you are. I know what you're going through. I understand your pains and your fears. Thirdly, we've got approval, verses 9 to 10. I know your affliction and your poverty, yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. 3 times Jesus says, I know your afflictions. I know your poverty. I know about the slander. And that expression, I know, can mean 2 things. I have knowledge. I'm aware of your situation. But it can also mean I empathise. I identify with you. I've been there. And of course, both meanings would be true in this case. What was the affliction that these people were experiencing? Well, it's twofold. First of all, financial. I know your poverty. Now hold on, this was a wealthy city. but the Christians were amongst the poorest of the poor. And the word used here literally means beggary, destitution, extreme poverty. When everyone else is loaded, these Christians haven't got two pennies to rub together. Many of them may have been converted slaves. Many of them may have been from the lower classes of society. But many of them have suffered for their faith. Again, I think of the Christians in Pakistan. And there's a big hoo-ha about two years ago about it. Even the government official got into trouble internationally by calling Christians sweepers. He said no Muslim should ever sweep the streets. It's beneath them. That is a job for Christians. And in Pakistan, it's one of the few jobs Christians get. And in Pakistan, they're not called Christians, they're called sweepers, because that's the job they do. And of course, they're paid a pittance for it. Well, it happens today. It happened 2,000 years ago with the people in this city. In a rich city, they were beggars, the poorest of the poor. Not only poverty, but slander. Slander. Every religion in these days had to be registered with the Roman authorities. Once you were registered, you were called a religio licitia. That is, you were permitted, you were approved, a legal religion. If you were not registered, you were called a religio illicita, which means you're an illegal sect. And therefore, you could not be protected by law. And if you weren't protected by law, anyone could take advantage of you. You could be persecuted and not fear punishment. Which made it easy for the Jews, who were upset by the Christians promoting this Jewish Messiah who they'd rejected, embracing Gentiles into their fellowships, which they saw as unclean. And so the Jews went to the Romans and said, these Christians are not Jews, they are illegals. They are illegals. They deserve to be punished. We're told here that there was a synagogue of Satan. There were a lot of Jews in this wealthy city. And where you find good trade and you find wealth, you often find Jewish people. Now, Jews had got a dispensation. They were allowed to be registered for their religion without worshipping the emperor. Never happened to any other group, but it happened to the Jews. And so when they said these Christians are not Jews, and because they wouldn't worship the emperor, they couldn't be recognized as a legal religion. And so whenever they came into contact with Jews, the Jews slandered them. They told tales about them to hinder them and get them put away. In verse 9, Jesus addresses the slander instigated by the Jewish community. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not. Those are incredible words. Jesus was Jewish. And here he says that these people who are of the same race are not actually true Jews. What did he mean? One commentator, Michael Wilcott, writes this. The persecution at Smyrna was made especially poignant by the fact that the great enemy was the local community of Jews. These were God's people racially, but not really. And were in fact blaspheming God as the persecuted his church under the disguise of doing him service. Perhaps it was economic pressure from the Jews that brought the church to poverty and slanderous accusations against them. For Satan here means slanderer, that led them to imprisonment and death. Actually, what Jesus says here, he said to their faces in John chapter 8. Remember that great debate when Jesus looked the Jewish leaders in the eye and said, if you knew the Father, you would know the Son as well. But because you don't know the Father, you don't know the Son. Your father, said Jesus, is the devil. What does the name devil, diabolus, means? Slanderer, accuser. You tell lies, Jesus says, because that's your native language. You're of the devil. So Jesus said it face to face when he looked the religious leaders in the eye. You're of the right race, but because you've rejected the Son, you're not of the family. You're not a true son of Abraham. And he says it here in this letter. But notice Jesus gives these believers a glimpse of hope. He reminds them they are poor in this world, yet you are rich. There's different values, I guess, here, different perspectives, isn't it? So you could be the richest man in the world, but if you die, how rich are you after 1 minute after you die? You don't take any of it with you, do you? It's like the millionaire who died, and someone said, how much did he leave? And the answer came back, he left everything. There are no pockets in funeral suits. Don't know if you know that. You don't take anything with you. You never see a caravan attached to a hearse, do you? When you go, you leave it all. But when these Christians go, they gain all. They gain all. They are poor in this world, but they are rich in the world to come. Well, we then have this accusation. No, we don't. Don't know if you notice that. There is no accusation by Jesus against this church. There are seven churches, and two of the churches, Smyrna and Philadelphia, there is no accusation against them. They were good churches. They'd got their act together. They were faithful. Now, they weren't perfect, because you appreciate no church is perfect. It's like the poem that says, the perfect church I think I shall never see. A church that's all it ought to be. A church that has no empty pews, whose pastor never has the blues. A church whose deacons always deek, and none is proud, but all are meek. Where gossips never peddle lies, or make complaints or criticise. Where all are always sweet and kind, and all to others' faults are blind. Such perfect churches there may be, but none of them are known to me. There is no perfect church, but this church, no fault against them. They were spared internal problems, but they faced external problems. And the reason we have so many internal problems is we're not facing external problems. We're not persecuted from outside, so we fight with one another instead. There's some advice given in verse 10. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. Interesting, Jesus never said to this church, hang on in there, all your problems will go away. Wouldn't go down too well with the health and wealth preachers we hear about or see on our TV screens, would it? He never promised them riches. He said, actually, it's going to get worse. See, they'd already lost two things. They'd lost their money, they were now poor. They'd lost their reputation, they'd been slandered. And Jesus said, oh, by the way, there are three more things you're about to lose. You're going to lose your freedom. And some of you will end up in prison. You're about to lose your security. There will come a 10-day period of persecution. Now, that 10-day doesn't literally mean 10 days, according to the expert. It just means that there'll be a time of persecution. We don't know when it's going to end, but it will end. It's got a definite end. So what you've got may be taken away from you. And then thirdly, he says, for some of you, even life itself will go. You must be faithful even to the point of death. But for the believer, death is not the end. It's the start of a brand new chapter. And Jesus says to these faithful believers, do not be afraid. I will give you the crown of life. Remember what Jesus said to the thief on the cross? Hey, today, here's a man dying on a cross, publicly humiliated, but he says to the man next to him, today, you're going to be with me in paradise, in my kingdom. And so he promises these martyrs, hey, when your life is gone, don't worry, you'll be with me, and I'll give you a crown of life. Christianity is not just a way to live, it's a way to die, isn't it? And for the believer, death is not the end. And then finally, verse 11, we have assurance. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. If you want an example of that verse outlived, well, think of Polycarp. Let me finish with the story of Polycarp. Polycarp was a student and a disciple of the Apostle John. He grew up and became bishop, leader, pastor of this church in Smyrna. but in AD 155 he was martyred. Polycarp spent a bit of time on the run. He was a hunted man because he was a prominent figure. If you destroy the leaders, the rest fall apart. That's the idea. And so Polycarp was hid out in the country. But the Romans got hold of a servant girl and they tortured her. And under torture, she gave away the whereabouts of Polycarp. And so Polycarp was arrested. And he was taken to the Roman proconsul. And the Roman proconsul said this: what harm is there in saying Caesar is Lord, offering a sacrifice to him, you will spare your life? Under this particular government, once a year you made a sacrifice. You took a pinch of salt or incense, you burnt it at the temple, you said Caesar is Lord, and then you could go away and worship any god you wanted. Just as long as you, once a year, proclaim the number one authority is Caesar, all gods are below him. Of course, the Christians would not do that. And Polycarp refused. Well, the Romans said, look, say Caesar is Lord, make your sacrifice, you will be safe. And Polycarp made a famous speech. He said this: 8 and 6 years I have served him, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? The proconsul threatened him with burning. And again, Polycarp replied, You threaten me with fire that burns for a time and is quickly quenched. For you do not know the fire which awaits the wicked in the judgment to come and in everlasting punishment. Why are you waiting? Come, do what you will do. And they did. Polycarp was burnt alive. But he lived out, didn't he, that verse. Do not fear, said Jesus, and he wasn't afraid. Be faithful. He was faithful. Overcome, he gave his life. Second death, not for him. He got his crown, as did many more in that fellowship. Polycarp lived this letter and personalized these principles. Let's pray.